Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI declares a year of faith. Human rights and aid organisations, volunteers and individuals across the globe mark the International Day for the Eradication of Poverty. And the International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims reminds the world of its duty to care for the victims of torture in Gaddafi's dying regime. Benedict XVI has declared a year of faith, which will begin in October 2012, the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council. Speaking on Sunday to those gathered in St. Peter's Square, the Pope said that it will give new impetus to the mission of the whole Church to lead men out of the desert in which they often find themselves, to the place of life, of friendship with Christ. He also said that reasons, purposes and guidelines for the year will be set out in an apostolic letter to be published in the coming days. Lydia O'Kane reports.
It was in a packed St. Peter's Basilica on Sunday that Pope Benedict XVI declared that the year 2012 to 2013 was to be a year of faith. The Holy Father made the announcement during his homily at a Mass for the new evangelization. The Eucharistic celebration marked the conclusion of a meeting organized by the Pontifical Council for the new evangelization, which the Pope addressed on Saturday. Speaking about his decision to invoke this year of faith, Pope Benedict said it was to give a new impetus to the mission of the whole Church, to lead men out of the desert in which they often find themselves, to the place of life, of friendship with Christ.
Sarà un momento di grazia e di impegno.
The Pope explains that the year would be a moment of grace and commitment to a more complete conversion to God, to strengthen our faith in Him and to proclaim Him with joy to the people of our time. In order to illustrate the meaning of this year of faith, the Holy Father said he would prepare a special apostolic letter, and he informed the congregation present that the year would begin on the 11th of October 2012, the 50th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council, and would end on the 24th of November 2013, the solemnity of Christ the King. During the course of his homily, the Holy Father referred back to the meeting of the Pontifical Council, saying he was delighted that this conference had taken place in the month of October, a month of prayer, and just 1 week before World Mission Sunday.
Sono lieto che questo convegno.
The Pope underlined that there was no opposition between the mission ad gentes and new evangelization, although he added the latter was very urgent, especially in traditionally Christian countries, which have become increasingly indifferent and hostile to the mission of the Church. Drawing his homily to a close, Pope Benedict stressed that the new preachers are called to walk in the path that is Christ and to make known to others the beauty of the gospel that gives life. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. Every year on October the 17th, we mark the International Day for the Eradication of Poverty. Recognised by the United Nations in 1992, this day is celebrated throughout the world. But the first commemoration of the event took place in Paris in 1987, when 100,000 people gathered on the Human Rights and Liberties Plaza to honour victims of poverty, hunger, violence and fear. The day was inspired by the life and by the work of Father Joseph Rosinski, the founder of the Fourth World Movement. I spoke to Reverend Nick Edwards, chair of the ADT Fourth World UK Movement, about this annual observance and its significance. But first of all, I asked him to talk to me a little about Father Joseph Rosinski himself.
Mm-hmm. he was born of migrant parents in Angers in France and grew up in a family that suffered chronic poverty and exclusion. His mum sent him to church to serve at the altar as a little boy, and well, clearly that had a huge impact on him. Very kindly priest, he was ordained into the Catholic Church in 1946 and worked in industrial and poor parishes. But critically, in 1956, he was asked to go and be a chaplain to about 250 families living in temporary accommodation at a place called Noisy-le-Grand, just outside Paris. They were in Nissen huts in a muddy field. And he, speaking of that, said it inspired everything that he undertook subsequently, trying to work with the needs of those families, not in terms of charity as such, but just in terms of trying to get alongside them and develop the work. I mean, in a sense, the soup kitchens and the second-hand clothes markets were replaced by libraries and workshops and kindergartens and the beginning of a volunteer corps.
He was also the founder of this ATD, Fourth World Movement. I understand that ATD means Aide à toute détresse. Can you tell me about the movement itself?
Yeah, that was its original name. It's been shortened to ATD Carmonde, or Fourth World. Fourth World being the very poorest in society. And the movement arose out of the work in Noisy-le-Grand. Père Joseph invited people to come and volunteer to work with him on the basis that the important thing was to try and mobilize all sections of society around the poorest in order to allow them to develop their own voice, to speak for themselves, to be recognized and included and participate in society, putting the poorest first, if you like, because they understand poverty better than anyone else. I mean, from that's arisen a whole movement, which is now global, with working in about over 30 countries across all continents, with about 380 volunteers worldwide. To try and describe the movement as such, it's not a charity as such, providing relief to the poor. It's volunteers living and working in the communities in which the poorest people live, taking a human rights approach to their condition, working with them and supporting them on a grassroots basis in rural and urban areas, with the aim of creating awareness, changing the way in which poverty is seen, changing people's own conditions by their own efforts wherever possible.
You say changing the way poverty is seen. How can we do that?
Well, I think by engaging people with the poorest. That's at the heart of ATD's way of looking at the world. I mean, it's very easy to look from the outside and as policymakers or as individuals to say, well, this is why poverty happens and this is what we should do. But the poorest people are the people who understand best why they're in the situation they're in. And it's out of that engagement in communities, hearing people's stories, enabling them to tell their own stories, taking them into the places where they can meet with people who make the policies and develop our understanding of poverty, that we believe that real change can come in the world.
Now, poverty isn't just not knowing where you get your next meal. It means being deprived of the control over your own life, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And that's why it would be conceived by us as a breach of basic human rights. Poverty deprives people of the capacity to participate, to be masters of their own destiny, to do all that they might do as human beings. So one of the things that Father Joseph said was that he believed in a world where everybody could give the best of themselves before dying. And that's exactly what's precluded by extreme poverty. I mean, just in terms of definition, I think what we're looking at is that kind of long-standing generational poverty which traps people in a circumstance and deprives them of any capacity of fully participating in the world in which they live. And, of course, so many of the world's population find themselves in that predicament once you get beyond the basic fundamental absoluteness of poverty. The story that people tell is a very similar one across the world and across cultures. of not being able to be included and recognized for their humanity and their dignity.
It's terrible that so many children who are born into poverty don't manage to come out of it. It's a circle, isn't it?
It is always a vicious circle, and if you look at the UNICEF figures, they are quite horrendous in terms of child death and their deprivation and their... They're not counting. I think that's perhaps the way of doing it. They're not figuring in the world of which they are part, who live and die invisibly in the world, unnoticed in their passage through life. And in many ways, that just mirrors the predicament of poor people across the world. They're outside the frame of our purview of the world and what goes on in it. They don't figure, they're not seen, but they're there. And it's that a desire to make it possible for them to participate and be included, which I think we believe would radically change the world in which we live.
The word poverty, the concept poverty, fills the mouths of so many politicians, of so many people who get up on podiums and talk about the need to tackle root causes, etc. But maybe we think more of people in developing countries. In actual fact, so many people in the rich West are very, very poor. I think the gap is increasing between the rich and the poor. Who are the poor of today?
They are, I suspect, very much the poor of yesterday and probably the poor of tomorrow also. Again, I'm just sort of quoting Father Joseph. He talked about them being at the end of your street, just around the corner, nearby. They are the people who, for all sorts of reasons, are trapped in this incapacity to participate. I mean, it is getting worse, there is no doubt about that, and it's not just the current global economic crisis. As you rightly say, the disparity between the richest and the poorest is ever increasing, and the willingness to engage with the issue of poverty in the poorest is it seems, I think, diminishing, and that's why trying to bring it constantly to people's attention is so important. And in my own country, just yesterday, the news from one of the bodies that has an overview of how things are suggested that child poverty will increase in the next 3 years in this country from one in five to one in four children. That gives some measure of it. I guess we also need to have an understanding that there is, if you like, the long-term, I don't like the word underclass, but the people at the bottom of society. And, of course, that's being added to now by people who are being precipitated into poverty by economic circumstance. Some of them will escape when things change, but many will remain.
What meaning does a day such as this have?
I think it's essential that to have in the world a day where we gather around the poorest, where we recognise that poverty exists and that it is a scandal in the world in which we live. Again, Father Joseph said that poverty was created by people and only people can resolve it. The actual day emerged because in 1987, on the 17th of October, 100,000 people from all over the world gathered at the Plaza of Human Rights in Paris, where a stone was placed on that plaza, which obviously is a very significant, iconic kind of place, which had the words, wherever men and women are condemned to live in poverty, human rights are violated, to come together to ensure that these rights be respected is our solemn duty. Arising out of that gathering, which was quite extraordinary, thereafter the United Nations in 1992 declared the 17th of October as the United Nations Day for the Eradication of Poverty, and the Charter of the United Nations was changed to include poverty as a fundamental breach of human rights. And so on that day now, across the world, in cities, towns, up and down nations, people gather, sometimes around facsimile stones, sometimes just to have gatherings and conferences and meetings around the whole issue of poverty and the struggle to change the world in which we live so that we can conceive of the possibility of eradicating it. It's not a pie-in-the-sky desire. I mean, it is a possibility within human culture and society if we choose that it be our priority.
No, absolutely. With all the means we have today, as you say, it's a scandal that poverty still exists, but more and more of it is to be seen on our doorstep. Also, with all the refugees who are fleeing conflict and poverty in their own lands, it's more and more evident to each and every one of us. What are your hopes for the near future, shall we say?
In one sense, it is just that people as individuals and that policymakers and the people who can make a difference, and everybody can make a difference in some way, will actually engage with the issue of poverty, not see it as insurmountable, not see it as something that doesn't affect them, because obviously it can do. It can come to any house or any doorstep in time, to understand that it is something to do with intrinsic human dignity, that we should be able to enjoy life. But in so doing that, also to see that in order for that to happen, what must be the case is that our thinking and our action about poverty are not remote from the people who are poor. They are the people most capable of enabling us, by working together with them, of changing the world, to make a difference to the world in which we live. And we can't do that without the poorest, because it's their voice, it's their experience, above all things, which will make the change. I can't change the world on my own, but I certainly can't change the face of poverty in the human world unless we include the poorest as full participant members of the society in which we live. And that's what the whole of the movement ATD Fourth World is geared towards. It's that ability for people to speak for themselves, to determine their own lives, and to be participant. And it's helping that process to be created by creating meeting points for people.
Thank you very, very much indeed. Is there anything you would like to add?
Only to encourage people to engage with people where they are, the people who are in their street or just around the corner, as well as with those who have the capacity to bring social change. I mean, it's a mixture of just having that human contact on one level, so that we don't talk in a remote way, but at the same time also using whatever means at our disposal to try and lobby for or bring change in whatever way we can for our brothers and sisters and their children who find themselves in poverty.
That means not just dropping a coin in their cup, but maybe looking at them in the eyes, talking to them and engaging in a direct way as well, am I right?
Absolutely. That's the difference, and that's what will change things one day. Because as soon as we do that, then we recognise them and we recognise their dignity as being exactly the same as ours, and that we have a common cause.
As the era of the Gaddafi regime in Libya appears to draw to an end, more and more horrific human rights abuses previously hidden by Gaddafi's regime are coming to light. The International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims, the IRCT, a global umbrella body for 150 rehabilitation centres in 73 countries, is appealing to the international community not to forget its obligation to not only find and bring perpetrators to justice, but to ensure the provision of adequate rehabilitative care for the many victims of torture. Torture was rife in Gaddafi's prisons, and according to observers on the ground, the dying days of his regime were particularly gruesome, with human rights organisations finding evidence of mass graves and other abuses. I spoke to IRCT Secretary-General Britta Sidhoff, who told me that it's very important for the interim authorities in Libya to build credibility by not being as nasty as the regime they are trying to topple.
We are very concerned about the cycle of violence. Of course, we all know how the Gaddafi regime has been torturing for years, for decades in Libya. And it's been very difficult also for us to work there and address the victims of torture. But we also know how government in transition or administration in transition often cannot do away with torture. And that's why we think it's so important to try early on to address the whole issue of violence and to try and stop torture in detention and prisons. And with the Amnesty report today, unfortunately, what we have been predicting to know is probably true then. So I think this just leads us again to call for interim authorities, the National Transitional Council, and the international community to try and stop the extreme violence that's going on and to try and stop the torture that's going on and to very urgently set up some kind of rehabilitation scheme there. And we would be happy to help such a scheme. Of course, the problem for us is we don't have any money to do that, but we would be so pleased to go in and support those medical staff, the doctors who would be addressing those that just have been tortured, and to try and work with others to see that this torture is stopped.
So your call is both to the international community for support and help and to the new interim government, am I correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that it's a lost cause to ask Gaddafi to stop torturing. He's never listened for 40 years. Unfortunately, but we think it's very important for the credibility of the new National Transitional Council that they stay away from torturing and stay away from these atrocities that Gaddafi has been doing if they want to have credibility. And what we are calling on them is to really try to stop this, and we are also saying that we are willing to support the institution building in Libya that is necessary, and that the international community should, of course, monitor and try to stop what's going on and what Amnesty is saying is going on also, but also to try and build rehabilitation work for those people that have been tortured. And to when you rebuild the country, you also have to build establishments that address the victims of torture and that can do something about all those people who I suppose most of them are victims of torture from the Gaddafi era, but also to address what's going on right now.
Well, right now, Libya is receiving attention from the media as the situation there is evolving and fighting continues. But, I mean, the chances are that as soon as the situation stabilizes, there'll be no more mention, in the news at least, of the plight of the people there. Is that where you intend to really pick up with the help of the international community?
Absolutely. And I think we've all heard also about the migrant workers who are kind of trapped in Libya, and the particularly people from sub-Saharan Africa that look the same way as many of the mercenaries that Gaddafi has hired. And so therefore, they are allegedly also seen as Gaddafi supporters, which may not at all be the case. So it becomes a kind of people are from their African origin predicted as being mercenaries, but they may not be. So it's very important to break this whole cycle of violence, and to also that the new responsible persons in the interim authorities really are alerted by the international community that they may not torture. It's absolutely forbidden, and that they are losing their own credibility with their own people and also with the international community if they continue torturing the same way that Gaddafi and his regime has been doing.
Britta, in your experience now, Libya is a situation in which the international community did intervene for whatever reason, whilst it is not intervening in others. Do you think the fact that it took interest foresees that they will actually continue their intervention in rebuilding and in helping in many ways?
Well, of course, this is what we hope. I think it's very immoral to go in and protect the oil rigs and not to protect the people. I think if you have a commitment to stop terrible corrupt government and a government that's doing bad things to its people and torturing its people, you have to be in there not just for a short term but for a longer term. And of course, if we all want, which I think so, we all want a democratic Libya to emerge, then I think the international community needs to support institution building and democratic processes and support a civil society that wants to emerge in Libya. And that this is so important, because if one doesn't do that, then the whole Arabic Spring, it may even fail. And, of course, our concern, we are a small organization in one way, but we are worldwide. We are very concerned about the whole issue of torture, because we know how repressive it is, and that we also feel that very, very urgently there needs to be established some rehabilitation support, some clinics for those victims, so that those people who are currently being tortured and also the people of the past that have been tortured can see that there is a change coming. And in that way, rehabilitation also works as a prevention for further torture.
If they are adequately taken care of, do torture victims manage to overcome their ordeals?
Yes, I mean, very many people do so. You know, we are working around the whole world, and we have an example also from Iraq, which had a kind of similar situation some 6 years ago. And we managed to establish some centers, although they're very small, but still they were received very positively from the population. And I think that the international community does need to support the good work that people want to do as well. And I think we have lessons learned from many countries, also in Africa, that you cannot just go and say that now this regime has ended and start building a new one with only supporting, you know, let's say the industry or the oil production, but you have to rebuild institutions and give the Libyans in this case a chance to rebuild their society in a democratic manner. And we as an NGO, of course, are very happy to support whatever we can do.
Are you hopeful for a good outcome?
Of course, we're very hopeful for a good outcome. But it doesn't come automatically. I think this is the whole message. That's why we are very much reminding the international community on our website, the irct.org, and there you can see how we are working in different countries. And I think that a good outcome doesn't come automatically. So we have to support, you know, the good institution building and those good forces that want to stop violence and stop torturing, to really support them with alternatives and to take care of those victims that are there, to make a point of that this is not acceptable anymore.
Thank you very, very much, Britta. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I think also from a moral point of view, it's unnecessary almost to point this out on this radio, that of course from a moral point of view it's very important that you build credibility by not being as nasty as the regime you're trying to topple.
That's all from the English feature program today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.